Okay, we're in the book of John tonight. That's where we're going to start off. John chapter 19, verses 21 and 22. Jesus is on the cross. We probably do need to include some other passages, even though we'll be flipping around a little bit from some other books. So let's get some other helpers lined up. If we need help from Matthew 27, is there somebody that wants to take responsibility for that? Maybe reading some verses from Matthew 27. Anybody? Betty? Okay, if we need some help from Mark 15. Anybody want to be our Mark 15 helper? Kathy? And then from Luke 23, if we need some Luke 23 helpers. Anybody want to read from Luke 23?
I can do Luke 23.
Okay. All right, let's pick up with John chapter 19. I know with weather we've been out for a couple of weeks. But let's start with John chapter 19, verses 21 and 22, and recap just a minute or two of where we left off. The chief priests of the Jews therefore said to Pilate, "Write not." Now these guys come, the chief priests of the Jews, they come to Pilate and they say, "We don't want you to write the King of the Jews, but we want you to write that he said, 'I am the King of the Jews.'" Why do you think they wanted that changed? Not that he is King of the Jews, but write that he said he was King of the Jews.
They don't want to believe it themselves if they allow that up, coming up to that he's King of the Jews, and then they kind of have to go along with that, at least.
Right, it's a way of stepping back from that. That is an important point. Is there another important point that you can add right by that, side by side with it?
They don't want any of those people that are going by to think that.
Okay, that's also an important point. Remember what we've said about crucifixion before. It was a deterrent. In other words, if you see somebody charged with crime X and they're being crucified, that was a way of saying, you don't want to commit crime X. Otherwise, you're going to be on the cross as well. Now, what was written about Jesus? He is the King of the Jews. Were the Jews interested in the king?
They were interested.
They were interested in one. So Jesus hasn't worked out too well for them in their mind. So if they're thinking forward a little bit, and they're thinking, Jesus wasn't it, but we're still anticipating one, and in a year, 6 months, 5 years, another guy shows up, and he's King of the Jews. Uh-oh, is that going to be a problem for us? Yeah, because this Jesus guy who showed up, he said he was King of the Jews, the Romans crucified him. And if they could do that for him, then when the quote-unquote real king shows up, what's likely going to happen to him? He's also going to end up crucified. So I think, especially when you look at the fact that it's the chief priests who go to Pilate and say, don't write that. Write that he said that. That also has to be put up there because that was a really important point. And these fellows were, I think, looking a little bit further down the history line to head off what likely would have been a big, big problem for them at a later time. Now, we also had a little bit of a discussion as far as when you look at something in the New Testament, the Bible will say, for example, it's written, and it goes back to the Old Testament. If you go back to the Old Testament citation and you compare that with the New Testament citation, they don't always match word for word. Now, in this case, this didn't, I think, get adequately discussed, and there's not much to say, but I do want to make this point. When you think about Jesus and the cross, what was written about the Lord was written in how many languages?
Three.
Now, if you're going to write that in three different languages, not translate it by Matthew, translate it by Mark, and translate it by Luke, but you have three different languages, would you not expect some variation? Yes. So if Matthew records, for example, the Latin, and Mark recorded one language, and Luke recorded another, you would expect necessarily almost some variations in that. And then if you have perhaps John taking all that information and kind of summing it up, that would account for the differences. Now, there may be some other ways to account for the differences, but to me, that is a very logical explanation for why, when you look at the three accounts, they seem to vary, and then you get to John's account, and you say, well, we've got even a little more information there, and that also helps explain why his is even a little more different than the three. And then we talked about, too, you may recall, if you weren't here, the fact that if I give you some information, and I ask you to repeat what I said, and you do that to somebody else. Somebody says, I want you to repeat what Brad said. Do you think that you're going to repeat it actually word for word, every single word? No. But when we ask you to repeat what I said, we're probably going to get, you get the gist of it. You get enough there where you say, yes, that is what he said. But we recognize that when we say, this is what he said, we're not going to get every and every I and every, you know, so forth in there. All right, anything you want to add or ask before we read John chapter 19, verses 23 and 24? That's where we start. The soldiers, therefore, when they had crucified Jesus, took his garments and made four parts to every soldier apart, and also the coat. Now the coat was without seam, woven from the top throughout. They said, therefore, one to another, let us not rend or tear it, but cast lots for it, whose it shall be, that the scripture might be fulfilled, which saith, they parted my garments among them, and upon my vesture did they cast lots. How many soldiers were present at Jesus' crucifixion? It doesn't say. Now we know at least how many were there. At least four. I think that you very likely have more than four. You read about the centurion. There's no indication that he was associated with this. But at least four were present for Jesus' crucifixion, plus the other two thieves. Now these men, and we discussed this when we were talking about the casting of lots a few weeks back. They divided up the Lord's clothing. And, you know, as Jesus is dying for mankind, that's the thing that they seem to be most interested in. Logical to take the victim's clothing. You see that, I think, done back in the Old West as well. This guy shot, and there's not exactly a Walmart or a boot shop close. So the guy's out there in the desert, going to be eaten by the buzzards, and he's got that nice pair of boots. You're there. What makes sense for you to do? Take his boots. I mean, even if you can't wear them, maybe you can trade them for something. Trade them for a gun or trade them for a canteen full of water. And that's just how the world has worked throughout time. One source said, and I'll give you this quote, it sums it up well, every Jew wore five articles of apparel. There were his shoes, his turban, his girdle, his tunic, and his outer robe. Again, we're not told how many soldiers were there with Jesus, but you have four men deciding to divide up five pieces of Jesus' clothing, verse 25. Why do you think that these four guys thought that they would have the right to divide up Jesus' clothing? Let's say that there were a dozen soldiers at the cross. Once again, remember, you have soldiers being sent there in part because Jesus, there's concern about, you know, disciples and what they might do, plus the work of the crucifixion. Why let these four guys divide up Jesus' clothing?
Either they were the head of the group of the soldiers that were there, or either they were the ones that nailed him to the cross.
Yeah, I think that those explanations kind of go together, but that's it. That if you're going to do the bloody work of crucifixion, your wages are probably not all that great anyway as a soldier, so this is your benefit. This is going to be the extra that you get. So the text doesn't specifically say that, but I do think that that is probably the most likely reason. All right, so they divide up four parts. You've got the last piece. This was the inner tunic. This, most believe, would have been the most expensive piece of clothing. It would have been like a robe. It would have been like a long shirt, and it's all one piece. And if you start tearing that up, you know, it's just like a winter jacket. Somebody says, that's a really nice winter jacket. Well, if you're going to play tug of war with the thing, what's going to happen? You get one sleeve and he gets another sleeve, and it's not going to be all that helpful. So had the garment been torn, it would have been ruined, and they didn't want to do that. All right, anything you want to add or ask before we flip over to Luke? All right, Luke's going to help us. Let's head over to the book of Luke as a class. Let's take a look at Luke chapter 23. We'll start with verse 35 and read down through verse 38. So Luke backs up just a little bit, but again, you have there, they're coming to the place of the skull, verse 33, and Jesus, we talked about the fact that Father, forgive them, they know not what they do. That may have been said, that first thing from the cross as he's being nailed to the cross on the ground. And then you have in the latter part of 34, parting his garments, and then 35 to 38. And the people stood beholding, and the rulers also scoffed at him, saying, he saved others, let him save himself. If this is the Christ of God, is chosen. And the soldiers also mocked him, coming to him, offering him vinegar, and saying, if thou art the king of the Jews, save thyself. And there was also a superscription over him, this is the king of the Jews. Were soldiers the only ones present at Jesus' crucifixion? No. You have a number of other people also present there as well. The Bible says, Luke's account is that there were others. And as he describes that, he uses the pluperfect. So there apparently were some people who had been watching this for an extended period of time, and Luke says that they were beholding. That's expressed with the present tense. So sometimes something happens, maybe it's an accident, you're passing by and you get a quick look. That wasn't true for this. There were some people who were really watching what took place to Jesus. Now that's important because as you go back to the Old Testament, you may or may not want to flip back with me, that's fine. I'm going to go back to the book of Psalms and look at two Psalms. Psalm 22 and verse 7, and then after we look at that verse from the 22nd Psalm. I want to flip over to Psalm 109 and look at Psalm 109, verse 25. We'll start, though, with Psalm 22. You may remember that Psalm 22 is a psalm which has a lot of information, which look forward to what was going to happen with Jesus ultimately. And in 22:7 it says, "And they that see me laugh me to scorn, they shoot out the lip, they shake the head, saying, commit thyself unto Jehovah," that's verse 8, "let him deliver thee," and so forth. And that was one of the things that, as you look at Jesus, Old Testament predictions in the Psalms talked about the fact that there would be people who would be looking at him, mocking him, and that's exactly what Luke describes. That second psalm is going to be Psalm 109. Psalm 109, verse 25. "And I am become also a reproach unto them. When they see me, they shake their head." And that's exactly what was taking place. Matthew, who's got our Matthew references? That's going to be... Okay, let's take a look from Matthew chapter 27 and verse 39. Okay, so you've got some, they're sort of hanging around in the area, they're taking a look, they want to perhaps see all this taking place. And then you've got some other people, Matthew says, who are just kind of passing by. Just as you would be driving by an accident, you kind of get a quick glimpse, and they are certainly not being very kind to the Lord as well. Now, I've mentioned this briefly before, but we'll mention it again quickly. When you have people passing by, for example, if it's a wreck, and you say people were passing by on the road, that tells you that probably wasn't a country road, right? If you've got people passing by, that sounds like that's going to be maybe not the busiest road in town, but it does sound like that's going to be an area where you have a reasonable amount of traffic. And that's one indication to maybe indicate that where Jesus was crucified, it was close to a road that was a major road or a semi-major road. All right, let's take a look at Mark's account. This detail is going to come from Mark chapter 15 and verse 29. Okay, we don't know exactly who these people were that came by and they railed at Jesus, but as you try to put this stuff together, it sounds like there may have been maybe a sensation-seeking mob from Jerusalem, especially because Jesus was going to be the one who was going to be crucified. The wagging of heads describes contempt, it describes insults, it describes mockery. And as you look at what's taking place, you find people grinning, shaking of heads, making faces, sticking out their tongues at the Lord. The word wagging in Matthew 27:39 that was read just a bit ago, and it's also there in Mark 15, verse 29, means to shake. Mark also, would you read that once more, Kathy? 15:29.
"And they that passed by railed on him, wagging their heads and saying, ah."
There it is. That was so quick the first time it was easy to miss. They say what?
Ah.
Now, that's a word that you're just perhaps inclined to skip over, but we want to pause there for just a second. The King James, if you have it, it's going to say, aha. And some of the translations will word it slightly differently. The New King James says so. And I think you also have so in the NIV. What does that sound like? Aha. So. Aha. What's that sound like?
We caught you. You can't do that.
Well, okay. It would really fall into the category of amazement. Ah, why do you think there might have been some amazement? People looking at Jesus, ah. Yeah, I can't say for sure, but I think that might be the reason why. We thought you were the special guy. You know, you were the guy who could walk on water. You were the guy who could bring, bread from heaven. You were the guy who could cast out the demons. And now, you know, you're up there on the cross, and where's all your power? So I...
Yeah. Can you do that on the cross?
Yeah. So again, you can see the mockery and the derision, almost the blasphemy. The people are just starting to really heap it on from a lot of different directions. And the shaking of the head, we'll not look at the Old Testament references, but one would be Isaiah 37 and verse 22. The other one would be from Lamentations chapter 2 and verse 15. And again, the people are just doing everything they can to make fun of Jesus. Now, you would hope that some of the people who were doing that had not been healed by Jesus or helped by Jesus, but based on all the good that he did, I can't help but wonder if maybe there were some people who had been assisted by him, or maybe a family member had been helped by him, and now they sort of turn on him. Let's take a look at Luke chapter 23 and verse 35 for our Luke helper. 35, yeah.
"And the people stood beholding, and the rulers also with them, derided him, saying, he saved others, let him save himself, if he be Christ, the chosen of God.
Okay, so now you've got the people with who? The people plus the rulers. And they're making fun of Jesus. So it's like everybody that is in that area has decided to turn on the Lord. That word, which is translated scoffed in some versions, would, like the King James ASV, would mean turn up the nose. All right, as Betty mentioned, I think that was her a minute ago, Jewish rulers said Jesus had saved others. Now, you would think, if you stop there and ponder that for a minute, you would think that's an odd thing to say. He saved others. Why make that an acknowledgement? I mean, wouldn't that seem to be favorable? He saved others. Doesn't that sound like they're commending Jesus? Yeah. But again, it's not a compliment because they're thinking, you acknowledge that, yes, he did save others, but his power came from where? The devil. So even as they make this point that he did save others, the implication is we know where that power came from, and it was the dark side, so to speak. But they're saying if you're really the Christ, if you're really the chosen of God, if you are the Messiah, then come down from the cross. Betty mentioned this. If Jesus could destroy the temple and rebuild it in 3 days, Matthew chapter 27 and verse 40, he should have no problems here. Now, there's an interesting suggestion as far as how the original text can be construed in Matthew 27 verse 40. One fellow who's really good with Greek said, you who were trying to destroy the temple and rebuild it in 3 days. Now let that sink in for a little bit. You who were trying to destroy the temple and rebuild it in 3 days. Well, if they change things around to that, then that would indicate that Jesus had succeeded or failed. He failed. And now he's on the cross, and it's sort of like, what are they doing? You failed with the temple, and now you're on the cross, and you're also failing here. You know, you find sometimes this happens with people. They rise to a prominent position somewhere, and it just seems like they've gone from this level to this level to this level, and they're not going to be stopped. But then all of a sudden, at about this level, something doesn't seem to go right for them. And you've got some people that sort of want to pile on and bring them down. You ever see that?
Yeah.
And once it happens one time, then who else is looking for it? Somebody else. And they just want to go ahead and chip away at this guy. And I think that you see that with Jesus, not that he ever had any failure, but they take this, it wasn't really a misunderstanding, they take this detail that they have twisted and they use that to start trying to destroy the Lord in some other ways. Tim?
Well, it says that they said he saved others, himself he cannot save. When I read that, and every time I read it, it's saying it to me differently. It's saying it to me as claimed to save others, himself he cannot save. And I think that's how they meant that. I think it was meant with a lot of sarcasm.
Yeah.
And that's how they meant that. He claimed to save others, and look where he's at.
Yeah. Once you start attacking somebody in this kind of way, it really doesn't matter. You're going to throw sarcasm. You're going to heap on them half-truths, outright lies, because it's just an outright assault. And it would be just like you're trying to fight somebody in a secular battle. You're going to take whatever is at your disposal, and you're just going to start throwing it their way, and hopefully something either hurts them, or as the old figurative saying goes, some of the mud sticks. And they're just throwing at him everything that they can possibly think of and do. You're right. Let's take a look at Matthew 27 and verse 42. Betty, that's you, isn't it?
He saved others himself, but you're not saved. If he is the king of Israel, let him now come down from the cross, and we will believe him.
Okay. If he's king, have him come down from the cross, and what will we do? Oh, then we'll believe him. Well, 2 points about that. What's that really imply?
They hadn't believed him before.
There's that. And if they don't believe him, whose fault is it?
Jesus.
It's his fault. Because if he really was who he claimed to be, then he should have come down. He didn't come down, therefore it was his fault. Now, once again, you can look at this, and you can look at a lot of similar situations in life. A person says, well, you know, I'm not going to become a Christian because of this reason or that reason or him or her or whatever it might be. If it hadn't been for her, I'd be a Christian. Hadn't been for him, I'd come to services. Hadn't been for this in my life, I would have believed the Bible and become a Christian. We've heard those kinds of things, haven't we, over the years? People say those kinds of things. Are they true?
Probably not.
Probably not. And you see that with Jesus. If only he would have done this. And that's, you know, a lie. I think there may be an even greater point than that, though. And that's really significant. But can you see how the devil might have been using these people? Yeah. Let's back up a little bit in Jesus' life. Goes into the wilderness, tempted for 40 days. Devil shows up with three special temptations. What was one of those temptations? You are hungry, you're suffering, so what should you do? Take these stones, turn them to bread, feed the stomach. Now move forward to the cross. Jesus, you're suffering. Come down from the cross. Everybody will believe you. It'll be good. Relieve the suffering, and you're going to be fine. The devil is repackaging that same lie. Slightly different circumstances, slightly different spin, but essentially it is the same thing. So as bad as what the people were saying was, and again, it was really bad, and the people really had no excuse. I think if you look a little more closely at this, you really have to see that it was something from Satan. And you also have to realize that Jesus knew better. Remember that little story that Jesus told about the rich man and Lazarus in Luke chapter 16? He said, even if somebody were to come back from the dead, would they believe him? No. He said, they've got Moses and the prophets, and if they're not willing to believe Moses and the prophets, they're not going to believe somebody who has come back from the dead. And in principle, that's the same thing here. Jesus, if he came down from the cross, these people still would not have believed him. All right, anything that you might ask before we look at verse 38, Trace?
Well, there would have still been people there that did believe. And when they heard all of this negativity, I'm sure that was weighing on their mind. Mm-hmm. Like, was I wrong?
Had Jesus come down from the cross, you think there would have been?
Nothing.
Okay.
Like, there were believers in Jesus.
Yes. Oh, okay. You're thinking the people who were the true blue and loyal folks, at least.
They're still there.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And they're hearing all this stuff. Yes, I do think that that probably would have attacked their faith. Now, whether or not that was enough to do any serious damage to it, certainly not with the apostles. But with some others, at least for a while, to the resurrection, it may have at least given them a pretty good shaking as far as what they were thinking. Like, well, he's on the cross, and maybe these guys are right.
We wag our heads when we see something that doesn't look right to us, or we think this person driving behind the wheel down the road, erratically we shake our head at them, and we go, what a moron. You know, we say stuff like that, and we rail at people, just like they did.
Yeah.
And we have to watch that, especially as Christians. We you know, I know when I see people that drive like that, and it irritates me, because they have no regard for your life, or the life of your children in the car. You know, it's one thing if they run into a bridge abutment to themselves in, but they want to take you with them.
Yeah.
And it gets on your last nerve sometimes. You know, you just go, I can't believe there's so many people out here that drive like that. Why aren't there more dead people, you know, than there are?
Well, the apple doesn't fall far from the tree, as they say, and we're not dealing with physical family members here. But you're right. And were we to face the kind of persecution, I think all of us, if we weren't hoofing it, we would at least be thinking about it like, I'm not sure that I want to stay around here. I mean, the apostles, you know, they fled. They left, at least for a time.
We just don't have a realistic grasp on the power that Satan has.
That's true. And until you are, what's the old statement about the Indians, until you've walked a mile in the moccasins or a couple miles, you know, be careful about judging them. And a lot of times, you know, people aren't even willing to put on the shoes before they start drawing some pretty negative conclusions. So it is a problem. It's a huge problem. Okay, verse 38 says that the sign containing Jesus' accusations. Now, again, this is going to be dependent on your translation. We talked about this a few weeks back. But the King James, at least, will say that there was a sign, and Jesus' accusations were written in Greek, Latin, and Hebrew. Now, probably the majority of the translations represented here tonight will not have that information in that verse. The reason for that is that is a textual variant. So there are some Greek manuscripts that have that. Chances are, though, that was not what Luke originally intended to include. However, if you were to look, and we did this a few weeks ago, if you were to look at John's account, John chapter 19 and verse 20, John does talk about the fact that there were these multiple languages used as far as that information being there above Jesus' head. So we do believe that. We know that that was true. But in Luke's account, there were some manuscripts that had this information, some that didn't. So if you wanted to discuss this with somebody, Luke's account would not be the best place to go. Anything that might add or ask before we turn our attention to the robbers? Okay, let's think about the robbers. Let's take a look from Mark chapter 15 and verse 32. Let's get some help from there. Kathy, is that you? Okay, 15:32.
Let Christ the King of Israel descend now from the cross, that we may see and believe, and they that were crucified with him revile him.
Okay, so we've got various officials mocking Jesus. We've probably got some sensation seekers mocking Jesus. You've got just all kinds of people around the cross who are heaping insults and, you know, probably grinning at Jesus' unpleasant circumstances, the great tragedy that's unfolding. And now, if that's not enough, the robbers who were crucified with Jesus also begin to join in the insult. So it's like the Lord does not have a friend there at the cross at all. So the next time you think, you sing that song, would I be a friend, or would I be a friend of Jesus? I don't remember exactly how the words go right now. Or I'll be a friend, I guess. You might think back to this time in the Lord's life. Matthew, let's go to Matthew 27:44. Betty.
Even the robbers who were crucified with him reviled him, the same thing.
All right, now that's interesting. Both Matthew and Mark say that the robbers were heaping insults on Jesus, but Matthew says they were using what? They were using the same insults. They were heaping on the Lord the same reproaches. Now, maybe that's really what was in their heart. Maybe they had picked that up from what some of the other people were saying. But Jesus was mocked in virtually every conceivable way. One source laid it out this way. His might was mocked, come down from heaven, or come down from the cross. And, you know, he didn't do that, but people were suggesting that he do that. His mission, his message, he was mocked that way. He saved others. His messiahship was also mocked. Let the Christ, the King of Israel, now come down from the cross. Now, as you look at the mocking that was done, there was a distinction, and it's subtle, but it's definitely there. There's a distinction between the mocking by the Jews and the mocking by the Romans. One fellow described it in this way. He said, the Jews mocked our Lord as a helpless Christ or a helpless Messiah. He was unable to save himself and therefore unfit to be a savior for Israel. The ignorant Gentile soldiers, on the contrary, mocked him as the helpless king of the Jews, without a crown, a kingdom, or an army, and therefore only fit to be ridiculed. The Jews scoffed at his claim to be the Messiah. The Gentiles scoffed at his claim to be king. And as you think about that, that's exactly right. The Jews would have been interested in that Messiah, the Redeemer. But the Romans, they're thinking, we're not interested in any religious stuff. We don't care about a Messiah. Who are we interested in? We're thinking in terms of a physical king, Caesar, the one who's going to be on the throne. So they said, look, you know, this is your king and so forth. You do have a reference there to vinegar. In looking at that word, it was a mixture of water, egg, and vinegar, and that was designed to stimulate saliva. You might take a medicine that is causing some dry mouth, and when you try to talk, it just feels like cotton mouth. You just can't get the words out. And if you are on the cross, you're going to have a state of dehydration. So if they gave you this vinegar, that was one final act of mercy. That would allow you to speak a little bit better, give you some saliva, stimulate saliva production. So if you wanted to say something, communicate something, that was going to help you a little bit. And then we talked about earlier, not in this class, but the gall, that's thought to have been a painkiller. So you've got those two liquids that were offered to the Lord. He didn't want the gall. He didn't want the painkiller. But he was willing to take the vinegar because, again, that allowed him to say what he did from the cross. Anything that you wanted to ask before we move down a little further? Okay, let's see what we've got in Luke chapter 23, verses 39 to 41. Still sticking with some information about the robbers. And one of the malefactors that were hanged railed on him, saying, Art thou not the Christ? Save thyself and us. But the other answered and rebuking him, said, Dost thou not even fear God, seeing thou art in the same condemnation? And we indeed justly, for we receive the due reward of our deeds. But this man hath done nothing amiss. Now, as you look at the accounts, Matthew 27 and verse 38, Luke's account also helps you with this. Luke chapter 23 and verse 32. John's account is also helpful. John 19 and verse 18. It tells you that two robbers, two malefactors, two really bad guys were crucified with Jesus. And you have to look at Luke's account and only Luke's account if you want some specific details about these guys. Luke has some information that nobody else includes. And one of the details that's included by Luke and Luke only is that one of the guys changed his mind at some point. We started out from the reference that Betty read, from the reference that Kathy read. They're both heaping on Jesus insults, and they're laying it on just as thickly as anybody else. But a time comes when one of the guys decides to shut that down. From Luke 23:39, we heard one of the guys saying, "Art thou not the Christ? Save thyself and us." He's taunting Jesus. The penitent thief, that is the fellow who has this change of heart, Luke describes this with the present tense. He asks if the other guy should not fear God. Now, there are times where you might ask somebody, shouldn't you change your mind? Guy says, no, not me. And you drop it. You don't say any more about that. But you might have another case where somebody says, you sure you don't want to change your mind? No, not me. And you continue that conversation for a little bit to see if maybe the guy will not have a change of mind. And from what I can tell, based on that tense, there seemed to have been a bit of a conversation perhaps from these two thieves. The one guy says, hey, you know, you need to start thinking this through, and this Jesus character, you know, think about who he is and what he's not done and all the things that he has done. He asks the other guy, he says, too, should you not fear whom? Should you not fear God? Well, he's on the way out, so to speak, as far as his life expectancy. You know, he's got X number of hours, you know, to live, and he knows that his time is truly limited. He affirms that he and the other fellow are there how? He says, we are on the cross
justly.
We deserve this. Now, that's pretty potent punishment, because this was, you know, a capital crime, and this was capital punishment. I mean, they were going to die. And it's interesting to me that this guy says, we deserve it. Not just that we deserve to die, but we deserve to be crucified. I'm kind of thinking, wow, what a statement from a guy. We deserve to leave life in this way. He says that he and the other guy were receiving the due reward for their deeds. So he doesn't try to weasel out of it. He doesn't try to say we're being punished too much. He doesn't try to say they got the wrong guys. He says, look, we are guilty and we need to pay this crime. How did he know that Jesus had done nothing amiss? All right, he's being crucified there in the area of Jerusalem outside of the city, and I think that, to me, is the most logical answer, that, you know, even though he had heaped insults on Jesus, a little common sense finally comes over him, and it's, you know, look, this guy wasn't a thug like us, he wasn't a murderer, he wasn't a bandit, he really was trying to do what's right. As you look at verse 40, what's that first word in your translation? But. Now, that may not be the first word in everybody's translation, but you should have something very similar to that. So you have this one guy, art thou not the Christ, save thyself, but the other answered. What's that but trying to tell you?
Well, the two of them had different opinions.
Yes, there's now a great contrast. There's a big divide between the two. And this other fellow has this big change of heart, which, again, you can see expressed with the present tense and so forth. Not everybody. When they come to the end of life, or they get really sick, maybe they have a surgery and they're thinking about death, not everybody begins to think about end of life decisions. But if you've ever gone to the hospital and talked to somebody who is about to have surgery, serious surgery, or you're talking to somebody that's got maybe serious disease and the doc has said, you know, your days, your months are limited, a lot of people begin to rethink life. And all of a sudden, what appeared to them to be many years ahead, all of a sudden it's now the future is dark because we think we're going to die. And people begin to think seriously about God and where they're going to spend eternity. And that seems to be what takes place with this guy, especially since he's in the presence of Jesus. Anything you want to add or ask before we go a little further? Tim?
Is this particular story, I hesitate to say story because it's true, but at this particular event, it's a good lesson for people who have lived a long time without being a Christian. And they know they should be, and their spouse probably is. And their answer to people all through the years was, I'm going to do it, just not now. And then when they reach that age, and they say, well, it's too late now, God's not going to accept me. And these guys, Well, the one, he realized they were only breaths away from dying.
Yeah.
And he realized, or he was hoping, that he could get some absolution from his sins. And Christ told him, this day you will be with me. So he could. And they need to, the people that are like that now, they need to understand that they should do it early. Mm-hmm. They should give Christ all the service they can. But even at the very last minute, breaths away from dying, perhaps, they can still have forgiveness if they'll do what they should do.
How about we talk about deathbed repentance next week? Sound like a good idea?
Yeah.
Okay, we'll do that. That was already planned anyway, but anyway. All right. All right, Luke chapter 23. Let's look at verses 42 and 43. And he, that would be this thief who's had this change of heart. And he said, Jesus, remember me when thou comest in thy kingdom. And he, that would be Jesus, said unto him, verily I say unto you, today you shall be with me in paradise. Now, was the remorseful thief familiar with Jesus' name? How does he address him? I mean, he was. He was familiar with Jesus. Now, how was he familiar with Jesus? Well, again, the text doesn't specifically say, but I think Tim's answer was Jesus had a reputation. And even if you're a bad guy, you still probably are going to know at least a few things about the good folks. So the fact that this fella had heard about Jesus prior to this time may be indicated back there in verse 41. Look at again at that. And we indeed justly, for we receive the due reward for our deeds, but this man has done how much amiss? Nothing. Now, for you to make that statement, that almost presupposes that you have some information about the guy. So I can't know everything that was in this man's heart, everything that he may have known about Jesus, but it does seem that he did have some information, and for whatever reason, he stopped hurling insults at the Lord and did have some desire to turn his life around. Now this...
He also knew something about Christ having a kingdom.
Yes, that's my next point. So, very good. And how exactly he knew that, I don't know. Maybe he had heard some of the preaching. Could he have... You think you ever have some criminals come in and sit through a worship service?
Yeah.
You think that was possible in the first century? All right, maybe he thought he could come in and steal. I'll give you this little tip. I guess we got a minute or two. Last preacher's meeting, Ray was there, went down there, and they were talking about the fact that there was a time where this person came in and you had someone baptized on this occasion. Well, a lot of the ladies went forward to greet the person who had been baptized. Well, if you're a lady and you're doing that, you think you're going to take your purse up to meet the person who's just been baptized? Yeah, I mean, you would think that here it's safe and you're going to leave your purse in the pew. Well, guess what? That person who happened to come in on this day realized, hey, there are a bunch of women up there and, you know, now is a good time to go and start picking up the purses. So they went through and I guess it was maybe this time of year and they had all the purses, kind of gathered together and then they put them under the coat and then they crossed their arms and then, you know, I imagine it was a little of this, kind of getting out to the vehicles and they walked out or the person walked out with a large number of purses. So we asked the question after that was brought up and discussed, if you were kind of our security people, what would you do? Would you have stopped the person or, you know, maybe shook them a little bit or maybe, you know, said, go on and shake your hand before you go and let the purses fall out? Now, what would you have done to have either stopped the person? So we had some discussions about that. But let's see. That got me so far off track, I lost my point. Boy, that doesn't happen too often, but I'm not quite sure where I was going with that. Anyway, just bear that in mind, I guess, if somebody ever comes in. But Jesus did talk a lot about the kingdom, and this fella had at least some knowledge of that, or maybe he had heard Jesus say something as far as the crucifixion. Maybe the Lord had been talking to these two guys as well. We simply don't know. We do know, though, what Jesus' promise was, and that was what? Today, you're going to be with me where? Paradise. Well, I think that paradise can be easily explained in a couple of different ways. Remember in Acts chapter 2 and verse 27, Peter said in talking about Jesus, he died, he was buried, and his spirit went to where? Hades, right? Acts 2 and verse 27. The King James is going to say hell, but it's actually Hades. That's that same place that you read about in Luke chapter 22, Luke 16:22. You have there Hades described as being a place where the deceased go. and the eternal spirits of the saved are in one section, the eternal spirits of the unsaved are in another section, Luke 16, verses 22 and 25. So Jesus says, look, I'm going to go to the Hadean realm, and were both of those guys going to go to the Hadean realm as far as the thieves? Yes, they were. They were going to go to Hades. But one was going to be on the bad side with the rich guy. Jesus would have been on the pleasant side, and on that pleasant side with him was going to be this thief. And Jesus said, this is going to be an area which can be described as paradise. That word literally meant a beautiful garden. So exactly what paradise is like after you leave this life, the Bible really doesn't say much. Luke 16 says that it is a place of comfort. It's a place of rest. But aside from that, there's not a lot of information. One of the key points that we want to bring out is that when people die, if they're among the saved, even if they're not, does the eternal part of them cease to exist? No. They continue to exist. They are just as much alive after death as they were before, but it is a separation of body and spirit. It is not a cessation. And that is a key point for us to remember. A lot of people think that, well, they're gone, they've ceased to exist. That's simply not true. A couple of the quick points. Did Jesus specifically say the sins of the thief on the cross, the penitent guy, were forgiven? No, he didn't. But he did say what? Today, you are going to be with me where? In paradise. And you're going to be with me. Well, for that to be true, what needed to occur? His sins were going to have to be dealt with. So Jesus did not, on many occasions, personally forgive the sins of people. We do have two other occasions, though, where this was done directly by the Lord, and you can find both of those in Luke, back in Luke chapter 5 and also in Luke chapter 7. Now, I'm not sure why Jesus personally forgave sins on a few occasions. I think the best suggestion that I've ever read is that that was one more way to show his power, show his authority. I'm going to show you my power by raising the dead. I'm going to show my power by cleansing the lepers. I'm going to show you my power by casting out demons. And I'm also going to show you the power that I have when it comes to sins. If you have the power, that was a discussion in Mark chapter 2. Who alone can forgive sins but who? God. So if you are personally forgiving sins, you must be deity. And that was how the Jews understood things and how I think that that needs to be understood today. All right. Not everybody believes that, and this is thinking about the Jehovah Witnesses, what happened with Jesus was understood or right in the way that we've described it. For example, the Witnesses, their verse says, truly I tell you, today, comma, you'll be with me in paradise. They changed the place of the comma rather than leave the comma prior to the word today. In other words, they would say, I'm telling you today that you'll be with me in paradise. And you find that little trick being used by some people. They will change punctuation or do some other things to support their denominational doctrines, and in this case, they need to change the punctuation to support their beliefs.